This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Well, hello there. Very good afternoon to you. Great to have you along this afternoon. A little later this hour, after the news headlines at 12:30, we'll hear from the Bureau of Meteorology, which is defending its new $4 million website. And it's doing that because there's been a flood of complaints about the refreshed look. The new site went live just last week, so I wonder if you've had the chance to take a look at it, and what do you think of it? Let me know on the text 0448 922 604. We'll get into that conversation after 12:30. Also today, the critical minerals advisor for US President Donald Trump is meeting with mining leaders in Western Australia this week. And at 12:06, we'll kick off with the grains industry latest, because a member of the Grain Industry Association WA Oilseed Council, Michael Lamond, says there's been widespread off-types in hybrid canola across the WA grain belt this season. The off-types don't appear to be having too much of an impact on yield, but they do create some management issues around harvest when growers have a high distribution of late flowering green plants throughout their paddocks. The prevalence of these off-types this season is so high, it could be the catalyst for the introduction of standards on off-type tolerance levels in the industry. Michael Lamond, what have you seen in the paddocks this season?
The ones that are most obvious are the winter types. So in a lot of the hybrid seed this year in the paddocks, there's an even distribution, even spread across the paddocks of late flowering individual plants, and then, you know, taking longer to mature, and then staying green while the rest of the crop is going off. Now, this is not a new thing. It's been, you know, with hybrid seed, we've had this on and off for quite a while, you know, 4 or 5 years, although the last couple of years have been particularly bad. And in saying bad, I mean it's across probably all companies to some extent, and in, you know, it's not all varieties, but in And in some cases, it's certain lots of varieties, and the same, you know, a different lot, it seems to be fine. So that indicates that it's a seed source issue. So what's probably occurring is there's outcrossing from neighbouring fields that could be kilometres away, and they're cross pollinating with the, you know, with the lines that are where they're producing the hybrids, and it also could be some sort of internal off types within the, you know, the parents. But anyway, the end result is in farmers' paddocks, they look a bit ratty. They're not even like growers are, you know, like to see them. They also do cause some management issues as far as desiccating and getting them to burn down in time for harvest. So there's a few other little issues as well. But the thing is, it's quite prevalent this year, and it's quite obvious, and it's across quite a few of the varieties, and quite a few different seed lots from probably most of the companies.
And in terms of percentages, how much of the crop this season has been affected?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, it's hard to put a percentage on it, because you might have one variety, you know, say in one store or somewhere they've got a lot that's fine, and another lot somewhere else that's not fine, that it's come from a different seed source, you know, maybe overseas or in Victoria or Tasmania or whatever. So, but the thing is, the prevalence within the crops that have got it can vary from just a very small amount to very obvious. You know, you could have sort of, you're walking along and you might come across an off-type every 3 or 4 steps. The issue is the seed companies don't really, I mean, they have their own internal standards. Which is about 5%, which is actually quite a lot when you think about it. Most of the, you know, when you look at it, and this is probably another complicating factor, is that when you look at it, you go, okay, is that 1% or less than 1% or 2%? And there's no industry standard on how you actually calculate it either. So all the companies got a different way of determining like what that is. And it just seems to be like, you know, counting's counting, you know, like it can't be that complicated, but it seems to be coming up with different results. So there's two things. There's no industry standard on, you know, really on what limits they have. They've sort of imposed their own, which are quite high. And they also, there's no real standard way of actually counting or determining it, which you think, well, it's fairly basic, really, because you can put a drone up nowadays and you can count anything. So that's sort of an obvious area that, you know, as far as the GIWA Aussie Council will be looking at is trying to, you know, raise this as an awareness issue. You know, we need to let growers know that, you know, that we'll assist in trying to get the various parties together and come up with some solutions.
What impact does it have on yield?
Well, this is the thing. See, if you're below 5%, it's probably not a lot. Certainly, if you're under 1%, probably nothing. But it depends a bit on your population density and things like that. I mean, it's probably not a lot on yield. It's probably more of a management issue. It's pain, you know, having these green off types, particularly as you get into the southern regions of the state, where particularly in a year like this where there's a soft finish. You know, when you get into the grain belt, central regions, as you run out of subsoil moisture, they sort of tend to burn off a bit themselves. You might have to just delay harvesting a little. But it's more in the southern areas where they can really hang on, and they're quite hard to burn down with a when you desiccate.
How much do growers spend on their canola seed every year? I mean, this is it's big business.
Yeah, well,
isn't
this
it?
This is the thing where it's sort of different to say cereals. I mean, there's the seed market in WA is worth about $140 million to, you know, that's what growers cost to get the seed, you know, a couple million hectares, so on. And then for cereals, which is four or five times the production, it's about half the cost. So it's a big cost to growers. You know, the canola is their most profitable rotation, yes, but it also is a big cost. And I suppose this is the other thing that growers have sort of mentioned, is that they don't feel like they're, you know, getting a lot of traction from the companies. I mean, not all companies. Some companies are very good at coming out immediately and having a look, and others sort of hold off, hoping the problem will go away, I suppose, or, you know, they won't get litigated against. But I think that's a part of the thing. The growers have spent a lot of money on their seed. It's a big input cost. It's one of the big ones behind fertilizer, fuel, and, you know, there's other big ones. So, you know, they're thinking, well, how come we're not getting what we paid for? The only thing that I'm thinking is, well, and again, others as well, probably, well, if we put more pressure on the seed companies to try and get this advantageous, you know, individual plants down, seed costs might go up because it's just harder to find areas to produce the seed.
Have any of the companies been paying compensation?
Not that I know of. I think in the, you know, probably 5 or 6 years ago, there was a few cases where growers felt that, you know, they should have been compensated. But I think in all those situations, the companies came back, you know, gave them, you know, seed. And, you know, I mean, it's one of those things. The companies, they don't really know, you know, when they produce the hybrid, that final phase, they don't know what the outcome is going to be until it's grown. So it's not like they've done it on purpose or they've done anything. You know, they might have stuck to their own guidelines. It could just be, you know, most of this outcrossing occurs from wind, not vectors. So it's just really hard to predict, you know, what might occur at distance. And so it's not like, you know, they're all trying to produce the best seed they can, but sometimes it just doesn't work. So, yeah, I don't think it's a compensation thing really at this stage, or it has in the past, but it's one of those things where there's probably a few things that need to investigate just to see, like, is it really creating a risk for producing mutations for blackleg resistance, you know, in your crop or in the future stubble, as well as just this management issue around, you know, trying to desiccate to get your crop off.
What needs to happen now then? I mean, the companies are aware of it, the off-type situation that we've been seeing, especially over the last couple of years, quite widespread. What are they going to do about it? What should they be doing about it?
Well, you know, maybe some absolute guidelines across the industry on tolerance, you know, whether it's 1%, 2%, 3% or whatever. And, you know, then the growers know that if it's exceeded that, well, then there is just a straight avenue for some sort of, probably not compensation maybe, but I don't know, replace the seed. The other one is the actual how they estimate or how they count the outcrossing percentage. We definitely need a standard on that, because they're all doing different things and it's confusing for everyone. And then the other one is to review the isolation distances. So, you know, with probably some new data that's a bit more relevant to nowadays rather than 25 years ago. And then the other one is to investigate what these off types actually are and see if they're causing a risk to growers as far as things like, you know, disease, creating a source population of, say, something like blackleg mutations that can confer resistance, you know, to the future crops.
Why don't we have these standards in place already?
Well, yeah, there aren't many standards in canola at all. You know, and this is a different hat now. This is Grains Australia. I'm the chair of the Oilseeds Council in Grains Australia, which is the peak grains group for money, market access and trade and education and standards. But there are no standards in breeding even for canola. And that's one of the first things that, you know, I discovered when I joined about a year ago, is that there aren't any. And the argument is, oh, well, the industry's worked together for a long period of time, the quality of the canola is well within global standards, and there's no need for it. But I think, you know, clearly when you get these sort of things come up, there probably is some need. And also I think going forward, depending on where the future of canola goes, feed, food or fuel, there could be some argument for some change, you know, some guidelines for breeders to, you know, to hit the very various parameters that they might be required.
So you think this is going to be the catalyst to implement, create those standards for hybrid canola?
I mean, it'll be, you know, it's, you know, whether it's GEWA or Grains Australia or whoever, we're not there to tell, you know, it's a platform of discussion and, you know, an industry, you know, to solve, really. Yeah, it could be. I mean, I'm not saying it is or isn't, but it could be. It could certainly in for as far as WA goes, you know, and the GEWA's influence, it'll be to get, yeah, we'll certainly be looking at the issues and maybe, you know, with the companies and the growers and trying to determine, you know, what the best things are that we can put in place to maybe sort of minimise this problem.
Michael, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Okay, good day, Belinda.
Michael Lamond, he is a member of the Grain Industry Association, WA Oilseed Council. I wonder if you've been having these issues at your place with these off types in the hybrid canola. Let me know the story at your place. 0448 922 604, text through and let me know the story. And if you're in a grain-growing region, on the Rural Report tomorrow, you'll hear about a roadmap that's just been released by the GRDC, the Grains Research and Development Corporation, looking at how we can boost oilseed production in Australia to feed an expanding international market for biofuel. So that's on the Rural Report in grain growing areas at 6:15 tomorrow. And then you'll hear more about it, of course, on the Country Hour just after 12 o'clock tomorrow also. 12:17.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio, WA.
The critical minerals advisor for US President Donald Trump is meeting with mining leaders here in Western Australia this week. Now, this follows last week's announcement. The US and Australia have struck a $13 billion rare earths and critical minerals deal. Joshua Kroon's official title is US Deputy Assistant Secretary for Critical Minerals and Metals, and he's in Perth meeting executives from more than a dozen WA mining companies. The Chamber of Minerals and Energy's Anita Lojudice sees this as a strong sign both governments are serious about the deal.
Look, we're really pleased that less than 1 week after the signing of the framework agreement that an official of this calibre is in WA, where we've got half of Australia's critical minerals reserve and we're already the fourth biggest producer of rare earth. So strong signal that both governments really are honouring this framework agreement.
So what does it mean for the critical minerals sector in WA specifically?
Well, details of the agreement are still emerging, but what we know is that the US government has displayed a willingness to enter into contracts containing floor prices above current market value in recognition that these minerals are strategically important and WA is a reliable and predictable supplier of them. So it just provides a signal to new entrants that there's appropriate recognition of WA's reliability and our high ESG standards, and hopefully it helps remove that barrier, which has been price, to getting these projects that require significant capital investment up and running.
And we are hearing some concerns from industry veterans who are sort of saying they're worried governments are underestimating the challenge ahead when it comes to processing critical minerals. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, WA is a stable and reliable trading partner, and we know that we've got the skilled workforce and expertise to quickly and safely develop new resource projects. So these projects are no different. But what we do know is that, you know, we do need to be very efficient in terms of all parts of government, both state and federal, working together to ensure that these projects can be implemented in the most efficient manner possible.
So do you think some of these companies have what it takes to compete against China in doing so in an economic way, I suppose?
So we've got world-class expertise in Western Australia. The main barrier has been price. So, you know, China is dominating these markets. About 90% of world supply chain is coming from China. It doesn't mean that they're not an important ongoing trading partner for Western Australian companies, but there is a need to try and diversify supply chain. So what this agreement does is suggest that the US government is really serious about entering into contracts that have got floor prices above the current market value. So it's that price that we've not been able to supply at, so that we can develop these projects that are strategically important.
And it's my understanding some of the agreements as part of this deal were non-binding. So how confident are you that this will result in real US investment in projects in WA?
So we've been less worried about that. With deals of this magnitude, there's always fine print. But, you know, I think the fact that we've got a visit less than a week after that framework agreement was signed is sending a very, very strong signal that both governments are actually serious about implementing the agreement, and we really welcome the ongoing dialogue.
And there are a number of companies, I suppose, or projects in the critical minerals and rare earth space that are sort of have been trying to get off the ground for the past few years. I'm thinking of Hastings Technology Metals, for example, in the Gascoyne. In the last month, their share price has gone up by over 200%. So do you think a visit like this and the confidence that it brings could be the difference in getting some of those sorts of borderline projects over the line?
Yeah, we're certainly hopeful about that. So one thing that I think we're all in furious agreement about is that demand for these commodities is not going to decline. So they're central to the globe's decarbonisation efforts, like needed to make a lot of the componentry that we need for renewable energy infrastructure. They're also central to digitisation, which is on an increasing trend throughout the globe. So we know demand isn't declining. What we've not been able to crack is price. So again, when we're seeing the US government displaying a willingness to enter into contracts containing floor prices above the current market value, yes, we're very hopeful that if that barrier is removed, projects like, you know, Hastings may well get the investment that they need to develop in the near term.
Anita Lodjudice is Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Chamber of Minerals and Energy, and she was speaking to Georgia Hargreaves. 23 past 12, shortly checking in with the news headlines, and then it's off to the Bureau of Meteorology. First up, though, after a long-running legal battle with the Western Australian government, the State Administrative Tribunal has confirmed the Henglers must cull more than 100 feral donkeys on their Kimberley property. Now, you might remember the backstory to this featured on the ABC's Australian Story TV show. Now the tribunal has released a 53-page document on its ruling of this case between Kachana Pastoral Company, founded by the Hengler family, and DPIRD, the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development. Kimberley Rural reporter Jess Baker has been following the story. Jess, what's the main outcome?
Hi, Belle. The State Administrative Tribunal has decided to uphold a control notice that was previously issued by the WA government, meaning Kachana must cull 117 feral donkeys on its Kimberley property and comply with reporting requirements. The tribunal found that the measures Kachana has been taking have not been enough to control the donkey population there, and donkeys are a declared pest in WA. So the tribunal said in its decision that although it could decide to mandate an annual cull over a number of years, it's not going to do that. It's decided instead that Kachana must comply with the control notice issued to them in 2021. But final orders are expected to be made by the tribunal this Friday, the 31st of October.
Now, for those not familiar with the background of this story, why did the Henglers choose to go to court over donkeys?
So back in August 2021, the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development, or which is more commonly known as DPIRD, issued Kachana a pest control notice ordering it to shoot feral donkeys on the station. Initially, 72 donkeys had to be culled, but that number has since been revised to 117. And the Henglers applied to review that decision, arguing it was unnecessary because it was sufficiently controlling the donkeys on their station. So Chris Hengler, who founded Kachana in the late 1980s, is of the belief that wild donkeys have helped to transform his land from dry soil into a thriving oasis. And anyone who have seen that Australian Story TV show might be able to see the changes to the land, which Chris has noticed too. So it was the Henglers' case that feral donkeys at their station are confined to a certain area, that being their home range, and that donkeys found outside the area were either herded back or culled. And they said they were complying with the Biosecurity and Agriculture Management Act because they were adequately controlling feral donkeys on the station. But it's now been determined by the State Administrative Tribunal that they were not.
And Jess, any idea what the Henglers think of this ruling?
I have reached out to both Chris and Bobby Hengler, but haven't heard back yet. I have spoken to them previously before. They're probably still going through the document because it is a long one at 53 pages. But I do imagine they'll be disappointed. They've fought pretty hard for a long time to be able to keep donkeys on their property because they truly believe it's helping to regenerate their land. They've even gone so far as to say it could revolutionise how the region manages bushfire risk. And Bobby was quoted in the SAT's document that the donkeys are an integral part in our management strategy of the environment, and we're managing the impact that they're having on the environment.
And what about DPIRD? What's it saying on this? Is it offering any spokesperson to speak on this ruling?
No, we did reach out to DPIRD, but they weren't willing to put someone up. They did provide a statement. They said feral donkeys are declared pests of agriculture in WA under the Biosecurity and Agriculture Management Act 2007, and programs are in place to control feral donkey populations where they impact agricultural production.
And is this the end of the donkey saga for Kachana?
So the State Administrative Tribunal noted in its decision that if Kachana wants to keep feral donkeys, it must persuade both the Kimberley Rangelands Biosecurity Association and DPIRD that the donkey population will not A, grow unchecked and uncontrolled, and B, disperse from their home range. It also observed that it might be worthwhile for DPIRD and the Kimberley Rangelands Biosecurity Association to consider closely and maybe even partner with Kachana in exploring what has been the effect of allowing donkeys to graze in the rangelands. So it doesn't sound like the end to me. It sounds like Kachana might just have to fight a bit longer and perhaps a bit differently to be able to keep wild donkeys on their property.
Jess, thanks for those details.
Thank you.
Kimberley Rural reporter Jess Baker going through that long-running legal battle between the WA government, the State Administrative Tribunal confirming that the Henglers must cull more than 100 feral donkeys on their Kimberley property. But I think it sounds like we need to be just watching this space at this point anyway. 29 past 12 here on the Country Hour, and Jonathan Beale is in the studio. He's got the news headlines for you.
Thanks, Belinda. The WA governor has apologised to the descendants of people murdered in the Pinjarra massacre 191 years after the incident. In 1834, then-Governor James Stirling led an armed group to ambush a Noongar camp in Pinjarra. Around 20 unarmed Indigenous men, women and children were shot and killed. Governor Chris Dawson has today told a remembrance ceremony in Pinjarra. The time for truth-telling has come. The State Education Minister says she she has confidence in her department's response to concerns about teacher safety in Kununurra. The comment comes after teacher accommodation in the town was burgled and vandalised as part of a youth crime wave which forced teachers to leave their homes. Sabina Winton says teaching staff should not have to fear for their safety. And a woman's been charged over an incident in Collie where police officers were allegedly pushed and spat on. Police say just before midnight on Saturday, several people were denied entry to a licensed premises after failing to produce ID. When several of them tried to re-enter the premises, an altercation occurred and a security staff member sustained minor injuries. A 41-year-old woman has been charged with obstructing and assaulting a public officer. More news, Belinda, at 1 o'clock.
Thank you for that update, Jonathan. 12:30 here on the Country Hour. And a few of you keen to jump in on the conversation this afternoon. Firstly, regarding the comments from Michael Lamond we heard earlier in the hour. Michael's a member of the Grain Industry Association of WA Oilseed Council, and he was saying that there's been widespread off-types in hybrid canola across the WA grain belt this season. Doesn't appear to be having too much of an impact on yield, but he was saying they do create some management issues around harvest when growers have a high distribution of late flowering green plants in their paddocks. On the text, Benno says the hybrid canola seed issue is quite simple. If seed companies want to charge a hefty price for a so-called premium product, they need to provide what we've paid for. If and when they don't, they need to stump up. That is all farmers want. If it's not up to standard, acknowledge it and provide a refund of some description. We don't get rewarded for growing poor quality grain. We just get paid less. The same should apply here. Happy harvesting, says Benno. Thank you for that. And you also heard how the critical minerals advisor for US President Donald Trump is meeting with mining leaders here in Western Australia this week. And on that, Helen says, just take a look at Baotou in China, one of the main processors in China for rare earth minerals. The thick, toxic sludge from processing has rendered a lot of land uninhabitable, and there are lots of health issues with residents who live close by. Thank you, Helen. Be part of the conversation on the text 0448 922 604. Just before the news at 1, we'll head to Mouche for the results of the sheep market. But right now, we're calling into the Bureau of Meteorology, and Luke Huntington is with you today. Luke, pretty warm conditions across, well, in the city anyway, but is that the story across the Southwest Land Division? I don't think Luke's there. I think we're going to have to get Luke on the phone, because our direct line to the Bureau doesn't seem to be working. So we'll just see if we can get Luke on the phone while that line is playing up on us. And between now and 1, we'll also take a look at this new cookbook that's out. It's been launched by the almond industry, and it's all about almonds. Every single recipe in the book is based on almonds, and they've done well because it's been written by celebrity chef Po Ling Yeo, who I think at this stage has been crowned Queen Almond. So she'll tell us about that cookbook that she's worked very hard on shortly here on the Country Hour. First, though, let's see if we can get the Bureau of Meteorology up. Luke Huntington, hopefully he's with us now. Hi, Luke.
I've got you, Belinda. How are you going?
Look, I was just saying that it's pretty warm conditions in Perth this afternoon. Is that the story for the rest of the Southwest Land Division?
Yeah, it is. Much of the Southwest Land Division going for warmer conditions today, just due to a trough off the west coast. So we're seeing maximum temperatures in the mid-30s through the wheat belt and the inland central west today, and through the Great Southern, temperatures close to 30. Into the lower west, we're also seeing temperatures in the low 30s, and even right down towards the Bridgetown-Margaret River area, getting close to 30 degrees today. It's going to be short-lived, though. We do have a cold front coming through from tomorrow morning, so temperature is going to be dropping back by about 10 degrees over a lot of locations. So a cooler, wetter change tomorrow, but it's quite a weak cold front, so there won't be too much rainfall associated with the front. So we're looking at probably 1 to 3 millimetres through the central west, lower west, southwest. But once you get inland through the Western Wheat Belt, Western Great Southern, you're only looking at sort of less than a millimetre or so. So it's not a great rainfall producer. And as we head into Wednesday, we see just another weakish front just brush the far southwestern corner during the morning. So that'll keep showers going for the southwestern parts of the Southwest Land Division. So through the lower west, southwest, western Great Southern area, again, around about 1 to 3 millimetres through that area. And maybe just a chance of a shower along the Esperance coastline as well. And then heading into Friday, there is another cold front approaching. It looks slightly stronger than the ones on Wednesday and Thursday. So it'll probably there'll probably be showers around Perth to Albany initially and during the morning, and then they'll pick up during the afternoon and evening as the cold front moves through. So maybe about 5 to 10 millimetres from Mandra across to Walpole, and 1 to 5 as you get inland towards Perth down to Albany, but only less than a millimetre once you get to the western parts of the Great Southern around sort of the Wagen Katanning area. So much of the rainfall will be confined to that lower western southwest districts. But that will move through, as I said, late Friday and overnight into Saturday morning. So on Saturday, we'll just be left with some isolated light showers across most of the southwest land division, 0 to 1 millimetre through the central west wheat belt, Great Southern area, but maybe a little bit more just along the south coast, 1 to 5 millimetres. And then by Sunday, that clears up as a new high-pressure ridge comes in.
All right, let's move into northern and eastern parts. How's it looking?
Yeah, today we're looking at showers and thunderstorms over the northern parts of the Kimberley. Nothing too untoward with those thunderstorms. They're just typical for this time of year. And it's fairly similar for the next few days after that in terms of thunderstorms. So all confined to the northern and eastern Kimberley for tomorrow. And then the same for Thursday. So the main areas there, Columbaroo, Kununurra, Argyle, that type of area. And then on Thursday, getting into Fitzroy Crossing and a little bit further west on Friday, but staying away from Broome at this stage. And then Saturday, it looks like the thunderstorm area does go into the Broome area and most of the Kimberley, and also into the northern parts of the interior. There could also be just a chance of a thunderstorm over southeastern parts of the Pilbara in the afternoon, and also in the eastern southern parts of the south interior and eastern Eucla at this stage.
Luke, thank you for all those details. Really appreciate that. It's 23 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Richard Hudson is in the studio now. He's got the rainfall figures for you.
Yeah, and today I'm determined to read out every single rainfall figure. So in the Kimberley, Kununurra Checkpoint received 30 mils, and then right down in the far southeast corner in the Eucla district, Eucla itself recorded 2, and that's it for the whole of the state. But whilst we're talking about weather, the Bureau of Meteorology is now defending its new $4 million website. So this is after a flood of complaints nationwide about the refreshed look. The new site went live on Wednesday last week, and that was covered on a number of our programs. Regional Drive, I think, we're talking about it, as well as some other programs. A week later, it sounds like some of you are still a little bit upset. Just got this text from Yogi in Tamman. I normally stay low in the trenches, but am compelled to speak out on the BOM's new website. BOM meaning Bureau of Meteorology. It's appalling. I feel like I've jumped in the TARDIS and gone back in time 20 years, particularly the homepage radar and the current weather observations page. The broad brush approach on the radar is shocking. Gone is our ability to have your own radar relevant to your farming area. Old site had great road network, distance and ability to refresh every 5 minutes. None of these features are available on the so-called slick new site. Not to mention how user unfriendly the site is. So clunky. What an abomination. Fortunately, the old site is still available for now on thereg.bom.gov.au. So that's from Yogi in Tamman. I don't think Yogi's alone. But meteorologist Michael Logan is the general manager of National Production Services for the Bureau of Meteorology, and he says It might take a while to get used to the new look of their website, but the old one was well and truly overdue for an upgrade.
The old website served us really well, but it had been well over a decade since there's been any upgrades to it. And in the background, the underlying IT just really wasn't as secure, as resilient and as reliable as it needed to be, and it had to be overhauled. And in doing so, we took the opportunity not just to improve the underlying IT, but also to meet modern accessibility standards and expectations, which is why we overhauled the look and feel of the website as well. So there's pretty good reason for it in the background. It wasn't just, as you mentioned a minute ago, change for change's sake. There was really good reasons for why we upgraded the website.
Okay, and so you've mentioned accessibility, but from what I'm seeing, that seems to be the main issue that people have with it. They can't find the information that they need.
Mm-hmm. I think accessibility is also the look and not just how you find the information, but how it's presented on the page as well, you know, whether it scales to the devices that you're on and some of the functions like that. But, yeah, I absolutely understand it is new. It is a rearrangement of where everything is, and it is quite a major change. So we are getting a lot of feedback around it. We welcome the feedback, and hopefully as people keep playing around with it and exploring that new website, they'll find all the information is still there, and they'll get used to finding that information and also the benefits of the new site itself.
So, Michael, are you confident that it is just a case of you've got all the information there, it's people just need to get used to it?
Yeah, we are quite confident. And one of the reasons for that is that when we did decide to change the look and feel of it, it wasn't a decision taken lightly. And we then went about designing that new website in consultation with the community to make sure it delivers the benefits that people wanted. So with all of that research and testing to understand how people use the new website, that's what actually led to the design of it. So, and also the beta websites, it was out there for over 12 months before launch, and throughout that period there was feedback that we've been adjusting to. So we are quite confident that as people get used to it, that they will enjoy those new benefits. But the other thing is, it's just the start of the journey, so we welcome that feedback. The website will continually get, change and get improved, and the feedback that's coming in will help shape how we prioritise and what we work on.
What sort of feedback are you hearing?
Yeah, you've touched on some of it. Certainly the radar, it's such a heavily used part of the site. We always get a lot of feedback on the radar. So the new look and feel of the radar gets a fair bit of feedback. The fact that it looks fairly similar to the app, but it doesn't go forward in time with that 90-minute forecast that the app has. The old website didn't do that either, but that's certainly some of the feedback that comes in. And like you've just mentioned, people use the website for so many different reasons, so much information on it, how they go about finding that on the new site, something that people are still looking through. But you can favourite things on the homepage, and you can customise the homepage on the new website. So as people start to explore and do that and favourite the things that they're used to wanting to see, we do think that it will be quite well received overall.
Michael, Dave in Mount Duran asks if I could ask you if there's an online tutorial to teach us how to use the new website. He looked today and couldn't find one. How are we meant to know how to get the info we need? It sounds like it's just a case of sort of teaching himself, is it, Michael?
There's no actual a video-based tutorial, but there certainly is a help page that we're consistently building out as we get the feedback in. So you'll be able to find that if you navigate right down to the bottom of the page under the links that are there. There is one of those takes you through to a help page with FAQs on the new website. So explains why the change, but also bits and pieces about how to navigate and make the most of the new website.
Someone's asked, did you test the new website with farmers?
I would have to go back and look at the demographics that were part of it, but I'm pretty confident that the answer will be yes. We did try to make sure we thought of a range of different members from the community and how they use the website. And so certainly agricultural areas would have been one of those. So I'm pretty confident the answer is yes without actually having the demographics of exactly who we tested it with in front of me.
And it's making it seem like you are taking this feedback on board. So can we expect little tweaks and changes to the website over time, perhaps if there are some things that you have been an oversight?
That's definitely the plan. So there will be ongoing releases of the new website, and we'll base what we work on on two things, some of the feedback that's coming through, and also there's still content that's on the previous website. And so the two are sort of coexisting at the moment. We'll be bringing more and more of that content over, and we'll also base that on feedback of what people want to see. It's very like what we've done with the app. It goes through, you know, ongoing release cycles, and we're constantly seeking to improve both of those channels.
Any chance you can just leave the old site running indefinitely, please?
No, we won't be maintaining both of them going forward. That's too much.
Oh. And I use the Bureau's weather app on my phone. Is there any plans to upgrade that?
Yes, there certainly is. And we do incremental releases, and, you know, like you would for any app. So new features are constantly coming out there. Some are probably a bit more subtle, and then others were quite major, like when we released the on the radar layer, you get not just the current radar images, but also that 90 minutes projection into the future. So there is definitely upgrades always coming through. We did pause some of the work on the app for a period there while we focused on getting the website live, but we will do incremental upgrades to both the website and the app going forward.
Meteorologist from the Bureau of Meteorology, Michael Logan, speaking to Debbie Rabitsky on ABC Statewide Drive in Victoria. 0448 922 604. That's the text. If you've had a look at the site, you've had a bit of a play around with it and your thoughts on it, a few of you keen to be part of that conversation. We heard a text from Yogi from Tammin a few minutes ago, and he wasn't happy. And Sandy says, I'm with you, Yogi. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. And then we've got this from Jason, who says, what did all the people like Yogi that are whinging about the Bureau website do when they either had to tune into the ABC for the forecast, ring the landline number, or heaven forbid, look out the window and use their own forecasting skills? This too, the new website is rubbish. It has nothing to do with it being new. Michael from the Bureau sounds very condescending, basically saying you are just too dumb to understand it. I'll be going to their opposition, says Tracy. In, where are you from, Tracy? Can't see. Also, the old BOM web landing page used to be the satellite image page, as all weather information forecast is derived and emanates from this. The Bureau can't expect to educate numpties about what weather is and how it is forecast if all the initial pages are just a bunch of numbers. The Bureau is now delving into belief-based weather, not straight science and data, says Ron. Thank you for that. This too, the Bureau's of Meteorology has left a lot of towns off the new radar map. As farmers, we need as much detail as possible. The old map was much better. John the farmer says, I've tried to ring the Bureau over 20 times since last week. I've left 4 voice messages on their answering machine that says they'll get back to me within the day. Reception does not answer. Maybe they could have spent the $4 million on wages instead of changing something that for many of us did not need to be changed. I think most of us were happy with the old site. I don't have email or any other social sites, so I need verbal instructions to help me find the new site. Please ask them to change it back, because it took me at least 12 months to work my way through that site, and I'm one of the over 60 average age farmers and not electronically savvy. The text is 0448 922 604. 12 minutes to 1. Well, one of Australia's fastest growing and largest horticulture industries, the almond industry, has launched a new free cookbook to get more shoppers, including the nut, in their meals. The cookbook is called Crunch, and it's been written by celebrity chef Po Ling Yao. She says it was easy to write a cookbook based on just one ingredient.
I think that's one of the reasons why I was so happy to come on board, is that the versatility of almonds is, it can be applied to so many cultures and also so many different types of cooking. So, you know, everything from desserts to savory to really light lunches as a snack, like it just has such a broad application. And I don't think there's many people out there who don't like an almond.
You're not the first ambassador, if you will, for an element of Australian agriculture. Most famously for things that we speak about on the Country Hour is the connection between Sam Kekovich and lamb. He's been the lamb ambassador for them for a very long time. Have you ever thought of giving yourself a title around almonds? I don't know if almond ambassador really works.
Almond ambassador. Let me think on that one. I am getting one of my friends are calling me the almond queen. It's a bit embarrassing to say that because they did make me kind of like a throne, this huge almond that was carved out, and I've sat in it and taken pictures with many people. So you know, I hesitate to call myself a queen, but you know, it feels like I am kind of taking on that title a little bit.
It's a step up from ambassador. Like, almond queen does have a nice ring to it.
Oh, look, it's really fun. One of the things that I really love about being involved with such a brilliant raw product is getting to meet the farmers and getting to see, you know, how everything's grown and just how it is a small miracle how these things land, you know, in front of us and able to be consumed, you know, because I went out on the farm and farmer was telling me, you know, if rain comes at this point when the blossoms are out, you know, it will basically wash half the pollen away and then you've got a terrible crop. And then just having to scare, you know, parrots away, and it's a real labor of love.
That would be interesting from I'd imagine your perspective too, not only being there for a brand, but this brand represents an entire industry, right? Like, it's multiple farming businesses, it's multiple regions of Australia, and it's a lot of people's livelihoods. And does that come with pride, responsibility? Like, how do you feel about that?
No, definitely pride and responsibility. And I think because it's, you know, in the region that I live in also, I think there's something that's very immediate that I connect to. And one of my very first potent memories of when we first migrated to Australia was actually in my uncle's backyard in South Australia shelling almonds, because he had these two giant almond trees and I'd never really seen almonds before. And I tell this story a lot, but I remember shelling them for so long that my fingers were really sore and smooth. I had no fingerprints left from shelling almonds. So it's just one of my most, lovely memories of sitting in the backyard with almond trees and all this stone fruit. So it's very much part of like my migration story for sure.
It's an ingredient you use a lot in baking wise with what you do with Jam Face. But I'm really interested in some of the other things that you've done. How are you inspired to create a schnitzel using almonds?
With that one, I'm just using it in place of flour, so anything that's gluten. So I'm using it as the crumb. So instead of using breadcrumbs, I'm using almond flour, almond meal, mixed with a bit of parmesan and herbs, and it is just the most delicious coating. And I think also in its raw form, you know, to turn it into a butter, I've used it instead of tahini, and then to soak it and then blend it. So it's kind of like the body for a curry instead of lentils or with lentils.
Of course I go for the schnitzel. Is there one recipe in this cookbook for you that you're either really proud of the thinking that went into creating that one, or just one that you really love to eat?
You know what? This sounds so weird, but one of my favorite ones in the book is the broccoli salad, because it's something that, like, I think when you look at it, it looks so, you know, humdrum, but with the almonds, it just adds so much like flavor to the dish, and it shows that you can add something that's just simple, like a well-roasted almond and chopping it roughly so you create lots of, you know, crunch and texture to the dish. And you can turn something that's just sort of like a very meager salad into something that is incredibly tasty. And I cook that one like probably, you know, once a week or once every 2 weeks. It's just one of my favorite sort of like no-brainers. And I think that's one of the things that I really wanted to aim for. You know, when I first started as a cook coming straight out of MasterChef, I think there was just so much pressure for me to, internal pressure, for me to be clever. And I think as I've become more experienced and more secure as a cook, the more I realize, you know, it's about making everything as simple and as accessible as possible. And so that's definitely one of my favorites in the book.
Celebrity chef and maybe Queen Almond. Poling Yao speaking to Warwick Long. And the cookbook is called Crunch. You can download it for free at the Australian Almonds homepage. So just search Australian Almonds, look for the homepage, which I'm doing here in the studio. It's pretty easy. It's right there on the front page there. Just click a button to download that recipe book, which sounds great, doesn't it? I really like the idea of that broccoli salad that Poe was just talking about, so I might do that this afternoon. 0448 922 604. A few of you keen to jump in on the conversation, especially regarding the Bureau of Meteorology's new $4 million website. Heaps of complaints have been flooding through about the refreshed look since the site went live last week on Wednesday. And a few of you with similar sort of concerns. Mark in Esperance says, it would seem the Bureau has dumbed down the new site as part of their push to further the climate scam. Knowledge is power, so you can see why they've done it, says Mark. This too, like many folk, I know I won't be using the Bureau's site anymore. Helen says, not sure how my husband and I can stand next to each other and get different temperatures and rain amount forecasts for the same places on the Bureau's new site. And also we were talking about the long-running legal battle with the WA government. It's come to some sort of conclusion with the State Administrative Tribunal confirming that the Henglers must cull more than 100 feral donkeys on their Kimberley property. So that's just been announced today, that particular ruling. You might have seen them on the ABC's Australian Story TV show, which is what Jim has done. He said, I saw the Australian Story on the donkeys. It looked like they had improved the land. So why doesn't the government listen to this bloke that has proven his method? It should be promoted, not shut down. Can't it just be simple and accepted for a change? Or maybe the government can't swallow its pride. The text 0448 922 604. I've got a few minutes left if you want to be part of the conversation. 4 minutes to 1.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today as Donald Trump continues his whirlwind trip through Asia. Today he's in Japan to meet Japan's new Prime Minister. New research indicates only 45% of federal agencies are clearly declaring their use of AI despite a year-old policy requiring them to. King Charles has been heckled over the allegations surrounding his brother Prince Andrew's connection to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. And a man survives a meteor strike while driving in outback South Australia. Those stories and more on The World Today.
3 minutes to 1 here on the Country Hour. Let's get to the market now. And about 4,200 lambs and 6,600 sheep sold at the Mouchet sale yards this morning. Terry Birkin's been at the sale today. Hello, Terry. Can you run through all the details for us?
Hi, Belinda. Today's yarding was approximately 800 down on last week, with slightly more mutton and around 1,000 less lambs. Quality was similar to last week, with heavy lambs in limited supply against larger volumes of secondary lambs. The buying gallery was well attended, however the market was softer in places. Lighter weight lambs were softer by $4 to $5, while trading lambs eased $8 to $10 a head. The mutton market was also back, easing $8 to $10, while heavy weathers and rams held firm. New season store lambs ranged from $90 to $180, while air freight weights sold from $170 to $196 a head. Trade weight lambs eased $8 to $10, selling from $180 to $212, while the odd pen of heavy lambs returned $230 to $243, with one exceptional pen reaching $271 a head. Old season store lambs started from $115 up to $151, while light lambs were selling from $175 to $190 a head. Trade lambs returned $180 to $192, and heavy lambs sold from $190 to $254 a head. Merino weather hoggets eased $8 to $10, with plain type selling from $120 to $172, and with more weight up to $205 a head. Merino ewe hoggets ranged from $77 to $190, depending on size, while crossbred hoggets returned $150 to $200, and younger rams sold to a top of $235 a head. The mutton market overall eased $8 to $10, with bone and grade selling from $90 to $176, medium ewes from $160 to $206, and heavy ewes sold to a top of $231 a head. Heavy weathers were firm, selling from $177 to $220, while mature rams were selling ranging from $70 to $220 a head. This is Terry Bergen for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks so much for that, Terry. Just going through the yarding for you. The lambs today at Mushay, 4,196. And the sheep, a total of 6,583. So all up, 10,779 yarded today. That's down on last week by 818. Not far away from the news at one, just recapping the conversation we had with Michael Lamond earlier. He's a member of GIWA's Oilseed Council, and he said there's been widespread off-types in hybrid canola across the WA grain belt this season, and it may be the catalyst because there's been so much around for the introduction of standards on off-type tolerance levels in the industry. And tomorrow we're going to look at oilseed production in Australia feeding an expanding international market for biofuel. That's on the Rural Report in grain growing areas at 6:15 in the morning, and then here on the Country Hour. News time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.